Thanks for coming this afternoon. This is our second ever Hot Topics, where we give you a view from 30,000 feet. The goal of today is to get your feet wet in something that's new, or at least new to many of us. Topics today include robotic parking and crowdfunding. We're going to start with crowdfunding. We've got, to my left, got to get my notes out here, we've got Mark Burkhart, if we can have a wave there. He's the founder of Selequity, and AJ Shveta, founder and CEO. Mark says he's a one handicap.
I wish.
And AJ loves playing the guitar. And with that, I'm going to get right into this. A couple quick housekeeping notes. There's a microphone right there in the middle. If you want to, you can interrupt all the speakers, but please step to that microphone, because we are taking an audio recording of this, so you can listen to it later, usually via the website. And without further ado, here we go.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Can you hear me all right? Great. First of all, I want to thank Brian Pointer for calling AJ and I up and giving us the opportunity to talk about equity crowdfunding. And that's really a different way of saying that. We want to talk today about a new way of raising equity, which I think is important for your clients, important for you, and I think we're going to show you new ways to make money. A little bit about me. My entire career was spent at some derivative of Turley Martin, Cassidy Turley, for 36 years up until a couple of years ago. For the last 25 years, I was CEO of the firm. And I just want to pause to recognize SIOR and what it meant to me personally and to our firm, and recognize a couple of people along the way. Those of you who remember Turley Martin, Ted Martin was the first CEO. He was an avid supporter, member of SIOR. And Ted introduced me to SIOR. Everyone in all the brokers in our organization came to this party and met a lot of people here. And when people ask me, Mark, what organization, as you were growing the firm, what was the most important organization? And clearly there's none other than SIOR. And I used to kid Pat Lindley and Ted Martin and others who would come here and have a good time about how much fun you were having. But clearly, when I think back of 30 years, how this industry has grown and how you have been on the leading edge of getting together, sharing best practices, and making deals. And that's what we're all about. That's what our firm was all about, is learning and being a better professional to our clients. So I'd like to thank all of you for what you've done. 2 years ago, when I left Cassidy Turley, I thought I was going to do my own real estate deals and continue to be involved in the St. Louis community, as I have been for a long time. AJ Shveta, who was the general counsel of Cassidy Turley forever, he was mainly a partner of ours, made me aware and others aware of this new idea because of the changes in the law of how to go about raising equity. It's really 2 years old, it's moving quickly, and in a few moments, AJ is going to do a better job than I can of describing equity crowdfunding, where we're going on some slides. But one of the things that bothered me over the years, kind of flowing into AJ's presentation, was even though our company, as it got bigger, was very involved in commercial real estate, very few people within our company were investing in commercial real estate. Ted Martin, who was my mentor, was putting deals together from day one, primarily for his top clients, Anheuser-Busch and other big companies who were located in St. Louis. He put deals together for the key executives and his family and friends. And I was fortunate enough, because I was helping Ted, he brought me on deals. My first deal at 25 for $1,200, where these big guys were writing huge checks. And that really was my first entry in investing in real estate. I've been very fortunate over the last 30 years to be involved with some of you in this room, SIORs, who put deals together. And because of my position with the firm, I've been in a lot of deals that SIR members, and I will tell you, I thank you, and my family thanks you for being in, for allowing me to be involved in those deals. But the thing that bothers me, and I kind of want to do a little poll here. How many of you, because I see most of you have been in the commercial real estate business for a long time, how many of you are regularly investing in commercial real estate? Pretty good amount. Not everybody. I would tell you in our firm, probably less than 5%. And AJ is going to give you the reason, but a lot of the reason is most of the people in commercial real estate, and certainly most of the people, which are now 8 million accredited investors out there, have had no access to investing in commercial real estate because it was basically against the law. Unless you were a family or a friend of somebody who was putting a deal together, you had no way of getting involved in good commercial real estate deals. And as AJ will explain here in a minute, that's all changing, and it's changing very quickly. And I think it's changing also for your clients. I mean, often your clients may have trouble either raising equity for new projects or you know, we're gonna talk about a number of deals where recapitalizing on deals was not really available until this law changed. So we're going to talk about a new tool that is readily available to you. AJ is going to speak, you know, formally about this, and then we're going to go about helping you visualize how you can help your clients do more deals, which means you do more deals, or perhaps even you being able to put more deals together. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to AJ.
Okay. Well, thanks, Mark. And let me echo Mark's thanks for having us today. We're really excited to be here and to talk about our new company. And we are a very new company. Selequity is a real estate crowdfunding company. But really what we are is a way to employ technology, to use technology to do private placements online. So we're still doing what many of you would have think about as traditional private placements. We just happen to be bringing technology to that and bringing those online, and that's available because of these new rule changes. So what we're talking about is equity crowdfunding, which is a way to raise capital from a larger number of individual investors, generally accredited investors, using online tools. And I want to distinguish that from in two ways from what you might think about as crowdfunding, right? So you've probably all heard about crowdfunding like Kickstarter and Indiegogo and those types of sites. Well, those sites are not equity crowdfunding sites. When you support a project on Kickstarter or Indiegogo, you get a reward. You get a product, an early edition of the product or a t-shirt, or you're helping somebody, finance their play. But you don't get equity in the underlying company that's making that product. So that's non-equity crowdfunding. And the reason that Kickstarter and Indiegogo and those all start with that model was that the securities laws really did not allow for raising equity in that way, okay? So that changed with the Jobs Act, which was passed in 2012, which paved the way for equity crowdfunding. So when you think about equity crowdfunding, instead of getting a reward, you're actually getting equity in an entity. You're making an investment in an entity. And in real estate crowdfunding, you're making an investment in an entity that owns real estate, or perhaps holds a note on real estate. So it's buying into a company. Generally, you're buying a limited partnership interest or an LLC membership interest. Sometimes it's stock in a corporation. But by and large, you're buying into an entity that has an ownership or some other secured interest in a piece of real estate. So it's not a real estate transaction. Nobody's buying or selling fee interest in real estate. There's no transfer of real estate. It's not a TIC. So, you know, with the TICs that were popular, you know, some years ago, we're actually buying and selling interests in the fee ownership of real estate. So this is a securities transaction. And that's why the rules are so different. And it might, you know, help to set the stage to sort of back up to explain sort of why we are where we are in terms of the way investment in real estate has traditionally been done. So the Securities Act and the laws that have governed the way we raise private capital, and here I'm talking about private capital, so I want to just very quickly just distinguish ourselves from publicly traded REITs or any other sort of publicly available, you know, thing that you can buy that's registered with the SEC. We're talking about private capital here. The old investment rules, which were part of the Securities Act of 1933, were really designed to protect investors after the Great Depression. And one of the key tenets of that rule was Rule 506B. And what that said was that if I wanted to raise capital in a private offering and not file a registration statement with the SEC and be a public company, I could only raise capital from people that I knew. So I had to have a prior substantial business relationship with those people. And that severely limited, obviously, the way that you could go about raising capital. And there, you know, over the 80 years, there were lots of rules put in place as to what that meant. But it really created this kind of insider's game where that, you know, if you were just an individual accredited investor, you could not invest with somebody that you didn't know. You wouldn't have the ability to find those deals. And you wouldn't have the way to find those deals because Rule 506B banned what's called general solicitation. So you couldn't advertise your deal. You could talk about it to people you knew, you could get referrals and then establish a relationship. But you know, it was this thing that we all know, right? It's this closed, you're calling people, you're meeting at the country club, you're doing, you know, your deal around lunch tables. And what does that do? Well, you know, that doesn't encourage technology. It doesn't encourage efficiency. And so there was really no driving need to bring technology to the fundraising process. Well, so what you had there were deals that were being offered to very few people. And because it was a fairly intensive, offline, paper-intensive experience, you know, if you were raising capital, your first instinct was, I want to go to as few people as I can go to, and I want to ask them for as much money as I possibly can. You know, I don't want this to be all that open. Well, real estate not only suffered from that sort of constrained capital, startups suffered from that constrained capital as well. And in 2012, coming off the recession, looking at, you know, how to create jobs, the Congress passed the Jobs Act, which stands for the Jumpstart Our Business Startups Act. And what the Jobs Act was intended to do was to create much more fluency and availability of capital for startup businesses. And it told the SEC essentially to change the rules, the securities laws, to make that happen. Real estate is kind of an unintended beneficiary of this law, and in particular in the way the SEC has interpreted the law and drafted rules. So one other thing I want to distinguish, I talked a little bit before about, you know, rewards-based crowdfunding, Kickstarter, Indiegogo, you know, you get a reward. There's another part of the Jobs Act which the SEC hasn't passed yet, and when you read about crowdfunding, a lot of times people are really referring to this, which is that there's a part of the Jobs Act that allows companies to raise $1 million from non-accredited investors. So accredited investors are people that make over 200,000 as an individual, 300 as a family, or have $1 million of net worth outside their home. So it allowed people who were not accredited to buy into small offerings by startup companies. The SEC still has not passed rules on that, and that rule doesn't have, you know, that much application to you know, sophisticated real estate transactions, because $1 million is probably, you know, a nice part of the capital stack, but doesn't move the needle. But what the Jobs Act did do is it changed two other rules. So one, it allowed for something called a Regulation A plus offering, and the SEC, even though the law was almost 3 years old, just in the last couple of months, passed rules on Regulation A+. That's sort of a mini public offering, and it allows you to raise up to $50 million for a project with less filing requirements with the SEC. But the really, really critical change, and the one that has the most application to real estate, and the one that we're working with SelectEquity, was the Jobs Act changes lifted the ban on general solicitation. So now you no longer are limited to people that you know or have a substantial business relationship with in terms of who you can raise money from, provided that they're accredited investors. So now you can go to any accredited investor, you can use technology and use tools to reach those accredited investors. And as Mark said, there are 8 million accredited investors in the United States. And those 8 million accredited investors control $11 trillion in assets, which is about the size of the entire real estate market. So it is a tremendous pool of capital that is very, very sparsely invested in real estate, and particularly sparsely invested in direct real estate, so outside REITs. Because these people just haven't had the opportunity to find their way into real estate deals. But now, you know, we have that. But how do we do that? Well, the way to reach those people clearly is through technology. And that's what we at SelectEquity are building, and what many of the other crowdfunding companies are building. So just to give you a sense of, you know, how big this is expected to get, it started in 2012. These are worldwide numbers, but the U.S. represents a majority of this. There was a little bit in 2012 that kind of happened on the edges. The rules went into place late in 2013. By 14, there was $1 billion. It's up to 2.5, the expectation is this year. But what's really interesting is the expectation is $250 billion a year of capital being deployed in real estate crowdfunding in the next 5 years. So it is a huge potential marketplace. If you've ever seen the graphs of sort of the amount of money invested in REITs when they were first introduced, we expect that kind of growth in available capital. So what's happening in this new industry? It is really new. Couple of things we're starting to see, but I don't think anybody could tell you exactly how it's all going to shake out. So let me just describe generally kind of what we're seeing. There are a bunch of different models that are being used by crowdfunding participants. First, there's a real distinction between crowdfunding sites in product type. So there are lots of sites that are very focused on a particular type of real estate. So there are sites that are focused only on farms. There are sites that are focused only on land. There are sites that are focused only on hotels. There are sites that are focused only on house flips. Some sites, when you read about real estate crowdfunding, they're going to be very, very, very focused on product type. Other sites are focused on investment type. So there's a very large number of the sites are focused on debt, and particularly short-term, higher-yield mezzanine debt, because they can get the money back to the investors more quickly. Then there's another sort of distinction between sites. One group of sites, and there's hybrids, obviously, of any of these, one group of sites is really a participatory model. So these are people who, maybe we call them sponsors. Under the securities law, they'd be called issuers. We think of them as, they're real estate owners, basically. They could be owners, developers, simply raising money for their own projects, deploying, their own website to do that. But then there are others who are not the primary owner, but are participating by providing a co-investment or investment alongside the crowd or pre-funding deals. So those are, I call those participatory sites. So they're participating in the transaction and getting paid sometimes by their participation interest. And then there are sites like ours, SelectEquity, which is, we're more focused as a service, but providing technology, providing marketing support. As Mark said, he's been personally invested in real estate, but we really come from companies. I come from a law firm, Armstrong Teasdale, and I'm still associated with the firm, and the firm is part of SelectEquity. We're a service business, as in Cassidy Turley. We're service businesses, so we're really focused on providing a suite of services to the industry. So that's roughly kind of how the market is starting to take shape. But whether you're a participatory site or a site that is more service oriented, all of the sites I think have some key features that we're that are starting to develop or that maybe you should look for or talk to your clients about look for, you know, as they are thinking about maybe doing a crowdfunded offering? And the first one is, does the site provide an efficient way to connect investors with the sponsors? There's a couple of components to that efficiency. One is the site. Does the site have the resources, and is it doing the things necessary, and is it attractive enough, for instance, to build an investor base that keeps coming back and looking for opportunities? How are they promoting themselves as a site so that investors think about coming back and doing repeat investments on the site? And then secondly, what can the site do for your client who might be a sponsor to help them engage their extended network and bring investors? So obviously, you know, they used to just talk to a few people that they do, but most successful real estate operators have, you know, much larger network of people that they could go to. How does the site help engage that broader network? And then how does the site help engage the local community? Because this is a new investment tool, and I think that until it becomes sort of as fluent as people, you know, got to be with investing online, you know, people are likely, and real estate's a local business, as we all know, I mean, people are likely to invest, you know, maybe in communities that they have some familiarity with, maybe projects they have familiarity with, or at least tenants or operators and owners who, you know, they've heard of before. So, you know, that's the lowest hanging investor fruit as you cast a wider net, and how does the site help you capture that? Another thing to look for is, how does the site help educate investors about commercial real estate? I mean, I think there's opportunities for SIOR members to help their clients and work with their clients to help educate a new investor base, you know, and bring the available knowledge base around investing in real estate to more people. Secondly, does the site provide a really easy and efficient way to share information? So project information about the deal is really the core and should be at the core of any platform. And does the platform provide that kind of interface that gives the investor the information that they need, allows them to digest that and consume it, compare it, look at different investment alternatives? One of the things we're focused on at Selequity is that, you know, we know that the data and the metrics and the things that you care about in underwriting a shopping center are different than you care about and look at when you underwrite an office building or an industrial building or a multifamily building. And how do you, you know, not only educate the investor about that, but how do you drive that data to the forefront of the way people think about and look at and compare an investor investment? And just because the SEC has allowed you to talk to more people, nobody's taken away the significant due diligence and disclosure requirements that, you know, are just part of any securities offering. The any fraud laws all still apply. So you do need to provide all of this investor information, and you want the site to be one that, you know, really effectively and efficiently delivers that information. Third, how does the site help the sponsor manage the transaction? So, you know, a lot of people, when we talk to them about doing crowdfunding, say, well, gee, you know, I kind of like it. I don't have that many investors, and so it's not that much work. Well, you know, if you have more access to capital for more investors, it is more work. So how does the site help manage the transaction? How does it help the sponsor track where investors are in the process, communicate with investors, move investors through the process, communicate with investors, you know, as they move through the process? And then how does it help the sponsor comply with some of the securities laws? So one of the key differences between a 506B private offering to people you know and a 506C deal, which are the new equity crowdfunding rules, one of the major differences between those offerings is there is a new obligation in a crowdfunded environment placed on the sponsor to be sure that the person that's investing is an accredited investor. Back in the old days, well, it's still the law if you're only talking to people you know. But if you're only talking to people you know, we've all probably seen these forms, and it's, you know, you check the box that you're an accredited investor and you self-certify and, you know, and you move on with the transaction. So that was fine, and the SEC thought that was okay because you knew the person, so you kind of had a sense as to whether or not they were an accredited investor. But if you're doing this online, you have no idea who's on the other end of the computer. So they placed additional obligations on that. So, you know, our site, for instance, links to a third-party provider who provides a verification of that person's accredited investor status. So the sponsor never has to get anybody's personal information and do that due diligence themselves. So look for that sort of thing with sites. Look for, do they provide easy funding mechanisms, document signing? So it's just all about managing more investors efficiently through a transaction so that the capital raise is simple, easy, quick, that sort of thing. And then finally, how does the site help the sponsor and the investor on a go-forward basis track the investment? Again, one of the things we hear from people, particularly, you know, private people who are putting deals together, gee, you know, it's really, you know, communicating with investors is hard. You know, people's, you know, things change, things don't get delivered, they claim they didn't get their K-1, I gotta write these, you know, every, you know, quarter I've gotta come up with new stuff. So, you know, good sites provide a platform for ongoing investor relations. So in our case, for instance, you know, what we have is a platform that the sponsor at any time can see all of his investors, can quickly go in and update, upload new financial information, deliver private documents to deliver someone's K-1 to that person, or deliver documents to all of the investors at one time. So, how, you know, how does the site support that ongoing investor-sponsor relationship? And it's really important for a second reason, which is that if you're a, you know, if you're trying to build your business by having access to more capital, trying to build your business by growing your investor base, you want to keep those investors engaged. You want to be in a position to talk to them about your next project. So it really becomes, you know, how do you do that and make that a very easy process for the investor? So those are some of the things that that we're seeing happening, you know, sort of as the industry grows, as these platforms grow, they start to take shape. How do you use this, and how do you use it to get more business? I think that's you know, a key. And you know, I'll let Mark jump in here, but you know, one of the first projects we did was a recapitalization of a shopping center, partly to provide liquidity, right? So, great opportunity with new sources of capital to provide liquidity in old partnerships, and then you know, maybe help your clients redeploy some of their locked up capital into new deals. But also to provide, in this case, you know, additional resources without, you know, redoing your loan, without doing other things, to provide, you know, additional capital to reposition an asset and provide for leasing. So,
well, a couple things. You know, the first deal that we've done is a partnership that's been around 35 years, an 80,000 strip shopping center at the best location in St. Louis. And the partners have been in this for 35 years, and I think, as you can imagine, some of them wanted to get out. In fact, a couple of them had passed away. But you know, you have a sponsor who has a great project, and I think prior to this opportunity, either the existing partners had to write a check, or the general partner had to write a check to get the partner out. And there was really not any motivation except selling the property to get to satisfy some of these partners. Now there's an opportunity at which we were involved with, which took out 40% of the partners, raised $2.5 million, and trust me, the people that came in to replace the founding partners were very happy to be involved in this project, where before they would have never had that opportunity. And the people who got out were very happy to get out and for the property to continue on. And the other thing that it provided, the property needed some upgrades. And so additional money was raised as part of this $2.5 million to put more money back in the project and you know, increase the value of this project.
So, you know, just to kind of talk through a couple of other examples of ways that we've seen crowdfunding be used and kinds of things that we're talking to people about. You know, obviously, there is the opportunity to, you know, do initial financing, or, you know, either in debt or equity, or raise capital to purchase a project. But I think this idea of unlocking capital, in providing for more liquidity, either for general partners who want to, you know, go on and move on to their next deal and take some profits, or providing liquidity to partners who may, you know, redeploy that capital somewhere else, is a really big game changer for the market. Because I think that when you look at some of the, you know, as a general partner, particularly, you know, minority partners that want to get out, the difficulties with taking them out are substantial without a third party kind of metric in terms of valuation, and that's exactly what this provides. You set the price, and if nobody's buying at that price, you know that you're not the right price. So I think this liquidity thing is for general partners or for limited partners is a big issue. And I think we're also, you know, talking with corporations about looking at ways to unlock capital there. So, you know, thinking about, you know, just sort of the normal sale leaseback kind of transaction, you know, thinking about a corporation, corporate clients of yours that might, you know, engage in raising capital through the crowd, still being in, you know, a much more of a control position than if they did a traditional sale leaseback. So those are, you know, those are some of the other areas that we see, you know, really early application. It's a very nascent industry in the sense that if you looked at, and I'm going to kind of make an educated guess here, so in terms of the numbers, because you see them sort of floating around, but, you know, there might be a couple of 100,000 users of all the crowdfunding sites out there, and there's 8 million accredited investors. So there is so much room to grow in this marketplace, and as it does grow and people become more fluent with it, I think we'll see, you know, even more application and a wider variety of kinds of deals that people understand and can get done. So I think we can take questions.
You're all very quiet. This is the most quiet I've ever seen it. A group like this.
Either flew in too early this morning or was out too late last night.
So I understand how you get in. How do you get out as an investor? That's the first question. The second question is, how does this differ from a TIC, from a TIC, tenant common?
Sure. So liquidity, getting in, getting out. So in any deal, just like in any private placement, you know, one of the key components of your deal is your business plan. Essentially, what is your expected hold period for the asset? So very often, you know, the asset has a very defined hold period. There, you know, maybe it's a value add. There, you know, you can see at what point in time you think you will have done the things that you were going to do to add value. So sometimes that expected hold period is very much upfront. Other times that expected hold period might be much longer. And here's one of the things we think can be really game changing, and that is that, you know, you can now say to an investor, well, we're raising, you know, $10 million. But at some point in the expected hold, maybe the hold is even as long as 15 years, and maybe at year five, we're going to go back out to the market and provide liquidity for a third of the equity and let people take the, you know, have an option, you know, sort of a, you know, like a stock buyback in, you know, in corporate America. You know, people could decide to sell back at a value that the general partner sets, or they could decide to stay in. So we think that we'd be able to build into deals greater flexibility on exit beyond just sort of promising it's going to be sold between years five and seven. How does it differ from a TIC? It differs a lot from a TIC. And, you know, if you think about the TIC rules, and I'm not an expert in this, but I just generally understand that, you know, in the TIC world, what most people were trying to do was find a way to do 1031 exchanges. And, you know, you were buying into an undivided fee interest in the property. And there were rules about, you know, everybody had to make decisions generally, and you had to have broader participation. You know, this is a passive investment. You know, much like the kind of, you know, investment that people expect to see in REITs or stocks, you know, they're not part of the decision making. So this is really an investment where the general partner can make those decisions, as opposed to having the TIC rules apply to, you know, how widely management is. I will say that, you know, it doesn't do what a TIC does or did in terms of a 1031 exchange. It's not to say that real estate crowdfunding doesn't have a place in 1031 exchanges or ways to facilitate it, but you can't sell your building and take your proceeds and buy equity interests online in a real estate crowdfunded investment and get 1031 tax treatment on that if you're buying equity in a deal as opposed to buying underlying fee.
So what is Selequity? What is Selequity's fee structure, and does the promoter pay that, or does the accredited investor pay it?
The promoter pays it, and we charge fixed. It's a fixed fee. We're not commission based. We're not broker dealers, so we're not the stockbrokers. It's a fixed fee for use of the technology. It does vary based on the deal, so I can't really say there's a specific amount for a particular deal, because it varies a lot on the services that we provide and whether or not we adapt our technology, specifically for a deal. But we provide a lot of additional marketing services, so things like helping with, direct marketing campaigns to investors, flying drones over your building and making videos, hosting webinars. I mean, we build a marketing package with the sponsor, and then that's how we calculate our fee. So it's a fee for services, and then a fee to use the technology for the capital raise. And then if you use our investor relations function going forward, we charge monthly fees for that.
Yeah. Is there a need for security licenses?
There is not in what the kinds of platforms that we do. We do not, so we don't provide any advice to investors. We don't charge commissions to investors. We don't charge transaction-based fees. So there's some things that we don't do because we aren't broker dealers. But there are other people that are more in that broker dealer model. We're more in the technology model.
Can you ask the crowd, who would be interested in doing it? Because I'm just curious as to the stats that you gave earlier about people that do what we do for a living that don't actually put the money in the business that we understand and know so well. So after, can you take a survey of people in the room that would be interested in doing it?
Sure.
Show of hands of people who
might consider crowdfunding.
Who would consider an opportunity
to
put. And I have an agenda because there's been a group of guys, SIOR people, with this Fjord Fund of Industrial and Office Realtors and Developers, and we've got actually the memorandum and the placement and just trying to get in. Out of the hundreds of people we've talked to, I think I've had three people that said no, and one of them turned to a yes as soon as they found out that Gabriel Silverstein was involved.
There you go.
And all I can say is that everybody said yes, and every time I bump into people, they're like, oh, geez, I feel awful. I'm going to send you guys a check. And I'm just shocked that people, I think one of the hang-ups was the discretion part.
Yeah.
But I said, wait a second. You're in your 40s or your 50s. You take all your money, you give it to someone you don't know. They invest it in things you don't understand, and most people that I know of aren't happy with the returns that they're getting, where right. You have an opportunity now to invest in something you know, with people you know,
right.
People you like, and it's just shocking that how it's like pulling teeth getting people to act.
Yeah.
And I said, too, with the market correction, I said, are you going to just sit on your hands and wait for the next market correction before you wake up? And that market correction was quite helpful in getting people's attention, but I don't, if anything that I have said, are you finding that in your business, that getting people to just finally make a move and actually cut a check is hard to do?
I think that we're relatively new, so I don't want to overstate the data. but I think the fact that most of the deals that we're seeing on crowdfunding sites and deals that we're looking at are specific projects is a big motivator. It's so different than a fund to see it, to say, and there's this sort of, there was a lot of hands that raised when they said, who's invested in real estate, which is great. But I think we all probably know that really good feeling of driving by something that we own. Right, and there's just an emotional connection that you can have to real estate or to investing in your community, and so I think that helps overcome that. It's not like just picking a stock symbol on a REIT or investing in a fund. I mean, you're kind of like, I can drive by that thing, or gee, I really love, invest. I'd literally love to own the thing where the Apple Store is, or whatever turns you on, right? I mean, there's just that emotional connection. We hope that's going to overcome some of that reluctance.
But let me answer it maybe a little bit differently. I think if you have a good sponsor who has a great track record and a quality project, my experience is you don't have problems people writing the checks. I mean, I have, you know, we all have friends out there who for 30 years are saying, hey, I want to invest in commercial real estate, but because I wasn't a sponsor but knew the sponsors, they could never get in. And I think to the whoever made the statement a minute ago, we're not here. I mean, my financial advisor would tell me to be diversified, you know. And when I look at where my money's going, I mean, where are you going to put your money? And that's what my friends say, you know, bring me deals, because I'm not going to put, you know, if you put 5 or 10% of your money, and I've got much more than that in commercial real estate, but those 8 million accredited investors, in my opinion, should be putting 5 to 10% of their money in commercial real estate. I mean, historically, I think we would all say that good commercial real estate has at least performed as well as stock market, and I think most cases it would show better. So this is about diversity in your portfolio, not going crazy. I mean, I'm from a conservative background here.
I think the other component to this that we see is interesting is that when we talk about crowdfunding, we're not in this environment of accredited investors. We're not talking about somebody writing a check for $2,500 or $500 or grandma, you know, investing her savings into, you know, into something. I mean, you know, the average, and again, it's really the kind of new data, you hear these numbers and, you know, there's not a lot of studies on this, but the average investment is in the range of $75,000 to $100,000. The average investor is 29 to 45 years old. So they're younger, sophisticated, tech-savvy people. And, you know, they're accredited investors. So they're probably not making little bets. They're making decent sized bets, but it's not that, you know, $500,000 or $1 million minimums that, you know, in the past, you know, people would love to have.
Got time for one or two more?
How big does the deal need to be for it to make sense to take it this route?
You know, it depends on the site a little bit. You know, I think you can do deals that are a few hundred, you know, $1,000, $500,000 to $1 million are probably at the low end of deals. And, you know, I think until there's a lot more fluency, you know, deals at, you know, $25 or $50 million of equity would be too big, you know, in some respects. So I think we're learning that.
Yeah, but I would say the $1 to $6 or $7 million raise is probably the sweet spot.
Yeah.
To get below $1 million probably doesn't make too much sense.
Yeah. Yes, there is leverage. So, I mean, again, that's part of your offering package, you know, sort of how much, you know, what the leverage, what the debt is and what the terms of the debt are and where the risks lie in that. So, and then, you know, timing, it's really hard to say, because when we look at doing this, I mean, when we talk to sponsors, you know, most sponsors do have a track record, right? Those are the ones we're working with, and so, you know, they're looking at, you know, how do we use this to enhance our investor pool? But it's not. They're also probably bringing some investors to the table too, and everybody's doing their deal. All the investors are you know, subscribing online, but it really, some of that timing really depends on what the sponsor brings to the table to start with.
We'll take one more.
Sorry. Question on dispute resolution. Does your platform or do the regulations provide for a separate venue or process, maybe an administrative process, if there is a dispute related to the investment, or is that left to the promoter's documentation like you would if you were dealing with other smaller amounts of accredited investors?
Yeah, it's left to the investor's the investment documents.
Well, good. I want to make sure we have enough time for Andrew Chaney, who's going to come up here next. But thank you, AJ. Mark.
Thank you all.
Thank you. We are truly at the tip of the iceberg if only 300,000 people are using this now, but there's 8 million more out there ready to spend some money. Say, I owe a quick shout out to the GotRack people. They gave us a little money, a little sponsorship dollars for this, and we wouldn't be here without sponsors. So thank you very much. She's right there by the microphone if you have any questions. And with that, I'll bring up Mr. Cheney, Lee & Associates, Arizona. He can plug in while I'm talking. One thing about Mr. Cheney, two things. He's got one heck of a newsletter that comes out, so give him your card. It's some of the best reading I get. And that's how I learned about robo-parking. It was literally on a phone call booking these breakout sessions, and I was looking through my inbox, saw his article about robotic parking. I basically picked up the phone during the, or sent him an email during the conference call and said, will you speak? And here we are today. So technology does work. And in Andrew's free time, he's an avid tennis player. And with that, I will stall for two more seconds. Oh, right.
Going?
There you go.
All right. How's everyone doing? Good. Well, I was the finalist for the Prologis speaker series tomorrow morning, but lost out, so they stuck me at 4:30 on Thursday afternoon. So I'm going to do my best to keep everyone off their cell phones and off their Facebook chats and their Instagram feeds. And, you know, we do... I think this is a decent topic. I don't know everything about robotic parking, but I've learned quite a lot over the last few months. And feel free to interrupt me with any questions. Just don't boo or anything like that. So with that, that's me, by the way. That's my email address if you want to send me your deals in Phoenix, Arizona. That's what Arizona looks like. I did take that picture for the record, just so you guys know. That's my team. We're awesome. That's our newsletter. It's even more awesome. It's our weekly voice. Yeah, that also comes up. So what are we covering today? The need for robotic parking, the costs, the applications, positive impacts, limitations, examples, a couple laughs. Did anyone go to my presentation on office trends in Scottsdale? Okay. How was that?
Great.
Okay. All right. So got pumped a little bit of life into this. All right. So understanding the need, obviously all the country's population growth is happening in urban areas, and so except for a couple examples in Kansas and other states you wouldn't usually think of, I just saw one guy yawning in the back, we are going to be talking about more urban areas. Today there's 253 billion cars on the road, and it's only growing, so this is becoming an issue. The densification of office space, so land costs are going up and companies are trying to pack more of their employees into these spaces. And so what's happening now, even at my little suburban office buildings, some of them in Phoenix, these guys are coming in and they want a 7 per 1,000 parking ratio. That's down from, it's a concession, they really wanted 8. And they want it in mid-rise buildings and high-rise buildings. So what are we gonna do? There's also, yeah, this is an illustration of another problem with parking and why we need robotic parking.
Crazy? What are you doing? Hey! You're stealing my space!
George, wait, you don't know who this guy is? People kill for a parking space in this city.
No, he's not getting away with this.
George!
What are you doing? I think I'm parking my car.
You can't do that. You can't just sneak in from the back like that.
I'm not sneaking. I didn't even know you were parking. You were just sitting there 3 spaces up.
What if you didn't think I was parking? Why did you put it in head first?
Well, that's the way I park. Anyway, you didn't start backing in until I pulled in.
I was in the middle of a conversation.
Hey, buddy, what can I tell you?
All right, the point is, I was here first.
I was closer to this space than you were.
But I'm backing in. You can't put it in head first.
I can if I have room.
Are you going to move the car?
No, I'm not going to move the car.
Jerk.
Oh, you're not?
Well, if this guy... Come on, we'll put it in the garage.
I am not putting it in the garage. It's my space.
What are you going to do? You're just going to leave it here like this? I'm going upstairs.
Are you coming back down?
Yeah, I got to tell Jerry we're here. I got to go to the bathroom.
Right, just make sure he reserves the good chair for me. What were you going to tell him about the clanking noise in the car?
Me? No, you. You're going to tell him. I'm not going to tell him.
Come on, you're good at this.
What am I going to say?
I don't know. You'll think of something. Just bring it to him, Jerry.
So clearly there's a need for it. All right, applications. Why robotic parking? We all know size does matter, okay? So this graph here, they're trying to show a typical conventional office building with ramp parking, 17 office floors, and with robotic parking, you can do almost 50% more office space and 48% more parking. Now, for the record, I've not seen robotic parking in office buildings in the United States yet, so this is a model. And this is what they're at. I'm sorry? I'm going to get to that. I promise. You'll see. This is an ad for an international parking garage, if I can get it up.
A land of 1,400 square meters can fit only 67 cars. You need to increase land size by 6 times just to put in a reasonable 400 cars to each commercial building. Or you can build a regular multi-level car park on 1,400 square meters of land, but that will only hold 210 cars. What you need today is an automated valet parking system that can double the capacity of a regular multi-level car park. Its integrated self-parking and security system makes it safer as well as faster because all movements are computerized.
So that's a big takeaway for today is they're trying to get a big selling point of robotic parking is double the parking stalls in the same amount of space. So what's the cost? This is taken from a study of a parking garage where they're going to do about 800 stalls, and this is the total, this is the unit cost per square foot. And remember, it's anywhere from $320 to $400, or $320 to 400 square feet per parking stall. And the takeaway here is that it doesn't start to make sense until you get below the building parking, and even then, below grade parking. So over here, $47,000 for a total cost per stall for conventional, and then below for automated is $35,000. Okay, this is what a developer in Manhattan put together for an 892 parking garage for a residential building. And obviously, as you'll learn, there's a lot of different variables that go into this, but his argument, he came up with a model that shows that it's cheaper to operate long-term an automated parking garage. One, real estate taxes go down because theoretically you've got less, you're paying on less square footage, and then also maintenance costs because you've got a better system in place, there's a certain life to conventional concrete ramp garage systems, and your maintenance is going to go down. So for that reason, that's why they're showing lower operating costs for automated. And then this project he put together, and certainly under the right circumstances, this could mean up to $6.6 million savings if you've got the right parking and your land costs are that high. This doesn't start to make sense until you get. Crap, there's another yawn I saw. Until you get to be have $80 to $100 a square foot in land costs. Positive impacts. Robotic parking garages can count towards 16 points towards the necessary 35 in LEED certification. Obviously, fuel use is down, carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide. Robots are more efficient parkers. We all know humans are not the best. Does that remind you of some of your kids trying to get out of the car? Safety, less people walking around and alone in the garage, and then this isn't going to happen. I hate it when this happens in parking lots and where I come from. I'll save you the suspense. He doesn't end up leaving a card. The reliability is it's up 99% of the time. I've only read about one story where a car got stuck in the middle of a system and they had to rescue the driver and the dog, neither of which were hurt. The convenience factor, so you'll see a sample here where you roll up, you swipe your card, and just like a vending machine, the machine brings your car back down to you. And you can already have your fees paid for, very seamless system. Limitations, again, as we talked about, the cost it doesn't make sense until your land costs get up to around $80 to $100 a square foot. The peak usage can create problems. So in residential buildings, it's not that much of an issue, but with an office building and everyone coming in and out of work at the same time, that'll be an issue. With queuing periods and parking designs try to allow for people to get their cars out within 5 minutes. So this is where the parking is in the U.S. This is a little bit outdated, but there's about 25 to 30 projects that are either existing today or planned. And as you can see, a lot of these, New Jersey and D.C. were the first ones in the U.S. in 2002 with parking garages. They've been going on in Asia and Europe since the 1960s, so just a little bit behind the curve. But you can see New Jersey, D.C., New York, this makes sense. But then you see something in Kansas, California, there's one from San Francisco. I was surprised to see this one in Jackson, Mississippi. There you go. All right. Here's a sample of how it works. This is from Philly. So in the United States, I see this coming more towards hotels, retail, multifamily before it comes to office projects. This is a project. Anyone know where this is? Have seen this project? Anyone from Hollywood? This is going on because there's very limited space in the area, and the city agreed to build this. They went from 67 to 200 stalls, and just to give you an idea, the project took... It costs $18 million, and so that ends up being $90,000 per stall. But because they didn't want to, it was California, they didn't want to deal with there's environmental issues, and the neighbors didn't want the views restricted, so they agreed to do that. But at you know, when traditional. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's tough. Healthcare, UCLA Medical Center. And this is a project in Edinburgh, Scottsdale, where they were able to add just over 50,000 square feet of office by using a robotic system in lieu of an existing one, of a traditional one. Then finally, here's another case for robo-parking.
Me? I was just parking there.
Oh, sorry. I didn't see you.
Are you mad? My car!
I'm sorry. Didn't see it.
Great distinction. Distinctly satisfying.
Talk about parking rage. All right, so brief summary. Robotic parking is still in its infancy in the US, I mean, less than 6,000 spaces. We've got a long way to go. The selling point is that they're trying to increase capacity by 2 times using the same area. Makes sense. Again, once up around $100 a square foot. There's many variables to consider, so you can't just, there's not a, hey, a one size fits all. I mean, your sites, you've got to look at the site and the many variables, the local area, the labor, everything, to really evaluate if conventional or automated is best for you guys, is best for your project. And I think it will become more common in the United States. I'm just not sure when. So with that, I'll open up to questions. I know everyone's got to get to happy hour soon. How are we doing so far? Okay. Right. Sure.
All right, there we go. Whoa. Say, I was Monday. Yeah, it was Monday this week. I was at a BOMA event, St. Paul, Minnesota. Twin towns, it's the smaller town. It's a 16 million square foot total market where Minneapolis is 30 million square feet just in the downtown for office space. And what we're running into over there, and we had a parking study revealed that the city had commissioned, but we're running into a lot of Class C and cool warehouse, old warehouse buildings being converted to the condo and apartment rage that we're all witnessing in all of our fair cities. What we're running into as office brokers is we don't have parking for anybody, because if you live downtown, even if you take mass transit, you have a car that you probably have to keep in your building or somewhere nearby, because we aren't giving up our cars. We might be giving them up to drive to and from work if we work, live, and play downtown, but can you comment on that, and are you seeing that in your market, and is this a potential solution?
I think it's a really long ways off, because it gets even more expensive to retrofit an existing project. So I think you're more likely to see developers scrape those buildings, put up parking garages. What's also interesting is there's in certain areas, has anyone heard of Parkopedia? Okay, Parkopedia is a new app that will show you every public parking spot in your city. And so I think people will use that. And other apps and other efficiencies before they really start tearing down buildings. But those are my thoughts.
Do you have any hints on Uber and how this affects how we all drive our cars?
Uber's so disruptive. I think they're still, at the end of the day, companies are trying to pack that many more people into these office buildings, and people still like their cars. So, you know, it's not like we're not Paris, we're not Europe. They really have to have it there. The US, even in our big cities, we still have a lot of room, and our public transport is just okay. So I don't think this is gonna happen probably for another couple cycles.
Question out here? I saw it. Oh.
That's a very good question. I don't know. Obviously, because you don't have as much human life going through certain areas, I think it would be lower. Certainly, the ventilation costs and lighting costs go down as far as the fire protection. I don't know about that yet.
The question is, can you fit most trucks or SUVs? And sorry, I didn't repeat the last question. It was about fire protection.
Good question. A lot of the typical heights are 11 feet in garages, so they're trying to get those down to 7 or 8 feet. I bet what they're doing is having just a small section of SUV vehicles. Hey, we're going to allot 25% of this section for big cars. The rest are going to be typical sedans. So, but yeah, they are trying to, I mean, compact them as much as they can. They've got to have, in America, you'd have to plan for that for the long haul.
Oh, it's funny, the 90,000 per stall was West Hollywood?
Right.
I thought there was some budget issues out there in California last time I checked.
Yeah, what are you talking about?
Sorry, there's my commentary on the government spending money.
Right.
One more, and then we'll, two more, here we go. Dwayne, go.
So the question, I've missed the first part. You're asking how does automatic cars?
The Apple car and the Google car.
Gosh, I guess you'll just get out of your car and get out of your house and everything will be automated until you walk up to your desk. Exactly, yeah. But I think we're going to see automated garages come before we see a whole ton of automated cars on the road.
Back here.
So far so good. I've only heard minimal complaints on there. Again, for residential, because I'm not in that world a ton. I haven't heard of any huge issues. But certainly, if you can afford it, it's great. I think there's been issues with retrieval time in certain projects. I think that would be your complaint, but as long as you've got the time and you like the convenience, I think it's overall it's positive. It's just still very, very expensive.
Any more? Bueller, anyone? I had to. I love that movie. Before we close here, we can have, did you want to come up now? You want to jump either here or wherever you'd like to do this? And my apologies, I didn't get the message.
No problem. My name is Alan Bridges. I feel inspired by this because I do racks, so why not racks for cars? I already do boat racks, so I'll be happy to. I think I could do that at West Hollywood thing for like 70 grand a spot. That's just off the top of my head, shooting from the hip. But anyway, that's what I do, steal. Anyway. I've been a sponsor for SIR for going on 4 years. I've done projects for many, many individuals in this room. And what we do is we turn your assets in your building into cash. The bottom line is, how many of you have industrial warehouse space where the tenant has abandoned racks, conveyors, any type of material handling equipment, mezzanines, things of that nature? That's what I do. That's what we do. If you haven't met Mary, you need to meet Mary. You will never, ever forget meeting Mary. Mary's over here in the corner. But that's what we do. We are Sanford and Son at a whole new level, okay? We are junk people. You know, I do that in colleges when I speak, and it's like crickets. It's at least some of you understand Sanford and Son. That's so refreshing. Anyway, that's what we do. We come in, we dismantle. Many individuals think the assets are worth more to a possible new coming tenant. Many of you know that's not the case. Those rack systems work for food. They don't work for auto parts. They don't work for furniture. They don't work for this. That's what we do. I had an erector set when I was little. I've got a kick-ass erector set now. I just need more erector set parts. So we come in, we dismantle, leave it broom swept clean, cut your anchors off to the floor, let you do what you do best, which is give the tenant a vision of what their products, their services, their manufacturing goods will be in that empty space. So let us give you money. I mean, come on, I come to these things. Let me give you money for these assets that are often a cumbersome distraction from what you're trying to do, which is close a deal for a tenant in an empty space with their vision. So let us buy and remove your assets. That's what we do. Thank you so much.